Welcome to the Archives of Conversation for Exploration. Timeless discussions to enjoy once again. Our program, hosted by Laura Lee, has its roots in the eternal questions about the human experience, with a mission, pushing the envelope and expanding our worldview. And while you may find the views of our guests fascinating, they may not represent our views or those of the Cuyamunga Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration.
And hello there, I'm Laura Lee. Thanks for tuning in to Conversation for Exploration, and there is much to explore with Alberto Villoldo tonight. His new book is Shaman, Healer, Sage, Discover the Timeless Wisdom of Native America. And we will talk with him about the Pachacuti, this ancient Inca idea of the earth turned upside down, a period every so often in history. This adequately describes events today, I think. We'll talk with him about the luminous body, similar to the aura or the halo depicted in Eastern and Western art that the Inca believe surround us all and that we can work with to effect healings. And we'll talk with him about the shamans and elders that Alberto has studied with for some 20 years, and their take on the world and humankind and our place in it. Alberto joins us from Los Angeles. Hello, Alberto, and thanks for being here.
Hi, Laura Lee. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. You're a classically trained anthropologist, and you've been studying shamanism, not just studying shamanism, you've been with the shamans many, many years. What got you interested in this whole field of study in the first place?
Well, originally I was studying mind-body medicine, the mind-body relationship, and we were understanding how we create psychosomatic disease, which actually we all become experts at about the age of six. Remember when you didn't want to go to school that day, and in 20 minutes you could develop all the symptoms of a major cold?
Yeah, or the placebo effects that so easily take place when you think something's going to work and maybe
right.
It isn't really there.
But
another example.
When you think something is not going to work, that works even more strongly. But anyway, in the laboratory, I was doing brain research and slicing and dicing and staining the brain and trying to look for the mind underneath a microscope. And what a number of us in the research community became aware of is that while we could create psychosomatic disease, we never learned how to create psychosomatic health.
Mm.
And those were the keys that we were looking for. And so I turned my eyes away from the laboratory, and I realized that the microscope was the wrong instrument to be researching this field with. And I needed something that would take me to larger and larger perspectives instead of smaller and smaller.
I see.
So I packed up my bags and I left a very successful career in academia. All my colleagues thought I was mad to sell everything and leave San Francisco State University and go off into the Amazon.
But you were on a quest.
I was on a quest to study with people whose notion of reality was much broader than the one that we had in the laboratory.
Yeah. You chose a good group of people to learn from, too, didn't you?
Well, I wanted to work with people who had not been influenced by the Western belief system, and who still lived in a very active dialogue with spirit and with nature. Because, you know, Laura Lee, we have the Western belief system is very unique in the world. For example, we're the only people in the world whose mythology says that they were kicked out of the garden. Nobody else in the world was kicked out of the garden.
Uh-huh.
The Hindus weren't, and the Aborigines weren't, and the Native Americans weren't. But in the Western mythology, we are kicked out of the garden. We no longer speak to the rivers and to the trees or to God.
I guess we're big on punishment, aren't we?
Very big. So I wanted to study with cultures who still walked in the garden, still spoke to the rivers, who still spoke with the mountains, and who still spoke with spirit, and to whom spirit answered. And that's what led me to the Amazon and to the high Andes to study with the Inca.
You know, you tell an interesting story in your book about, historically, about the reaction of the first Inca to the Spaniards that came over, and how they were handed a Bible and they held it up to the ear and nothing spoke. Mm-hmm. And you talk about how, do you want to finish the story?
No, go ahead. You're doing a great job.
You talk about how they threw the book to the ground and exclaimed, well, what kind of God is this that does not speak?
That's correct.
And I also thought it was interesting. Everyone knows how the native peoples here thought it was crazy to think that white men, or human beings in general, could own the land and own the food on the land and own the animals. But I hadn't heard this, that they thought it was crazy to think that infinity was restricted to a far distant future, or when you were dead, that they had access to infinity right here now.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. This is one of the unique understandings of the shamanic practice, of the shaman's practices, and it's not limited to the Inca, which are the people that I've studied with. And the Inca were an extraordinary empire. They had an empire larger than the United States. But you find the same beliefs with the Hopi, with the Navajo, with the Mayan, throughout the Americas, that you can taste infinity today, right now, that you don't have to wait until the end of time, until some future day of judgment when the living and the dead will be judged and we will again return to our original infinite nature, but that we can step into that nature today, right now, this very moment.
Why do you suppose it is that the earlier cultures all had that access to that Godhead, to that infinity, whatever you want to call it, and yet it was cut off to a lot of Western cultures? At one point, it was just kind of cut off at the knees. What do you suppose that was, a power play? How do you understand that historically, Alberto?
That's a very big question, Laura Lee. But let me give you another example that relates to that, because the traditions of the shaman, and the shaman are the medicine people, the medicine men and the medicine women. But they're not only, my approach with shaman, healer, sage with my book, is to take the essential teachings and to show how they're so relevant and applicable to us today in the West, because these are the traditions of the feminine, of the earth. These are very much a tradition of communion with spirit, and they're feminine traditions, whereas in the West, we have a very patriarchal, very masculine tradition that denies the feminine, to the extent that in the year 1564, the elders of the church gathered in Rome, the Council of Trent, to determine if animals, women, mm-hmm. and Indians had souls. And women just barely squeaked by.
And I still contend that animals have souls.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, it was determined that Indians did not, so that they could then be worked in the fields and in the mines like animals, and resulted in the death of over 20 million Indians in the Americas after that edict was passed. So the medicine traditions, the traditions of the Americas, are very much the way of the feminine, not the ways of control and command of hierarchical religious structures, but of immediate communion with nature, with spirit, with God.
And that's why that they considered humankind was a brother and sister to all the other life. Not to dominate it, but to be part of this web of life equally.
So how could you own your brothers and your sisters? If you were brother to the eagle, if you were a sister to the salmon and the dolphin, how could you own? And of course, that's a very Western model, that we own the land, that we own the animals, that we own our children. Well, we know we don't own our children. If anything, they own us. But that we own our spouses. We don't. The notion in the Americas and the notions of the shaman, and I believe that today we all have the capacity to be shamans in the world, the notion is the notion of stewardship, where you are a steward of the land, you're the steward of your children, you're the steward of a relationship, of a marriage. And today we have the opportunity, I believe, to be shamans in the West, where we can take on the stewardship of the entire planet.
Now, this gets back to the whole idea of the Pachacuti and why the shamans believe that, and in fact, one of them, you talk about Don Antonio Morales, chose you to be an ambassador to bring that wisdom to the West, and why they felt that that we need this wisdom to reorient ourselves, to reinvent ourselves, and to grow into this new human being. Could you tell us a bit about that prophecy and why this is an urgent time to hear this message?
It is. You know, one of the prophecies of the Mayans is that we are approaching the end of time, which is actually an Inca and a Hopi prophecy as well. This is all a gradual, incremental
shift.
Approach to a great quantum leap that's happening today. It's happening right now. That what's going to be happening is that a new human will be born, a new species. We're going to evolve into a new human. My mentor, my teacher, Antonio, who's an old Indian man, used to say, Alberto, this is the end of Homo sapiens and the beginning of Homo luminous.
You know, you talk about your mentor, Don Antonio, and how he became a shaman. He was struck by lightning, and you conjecture that that bolt of lightning rewired his brain.
Mm-hmm.
And one wonders, well, then what is the brain really capable of? You know, what would this new human look like? Will our brains just be functioning on optimal levels as they're meant to be? What does this mean? Because we have immense power in our brains that are underutilized right now.
You know,
rewire a few things, maybe we will be a different human. Maybe that isn't such a far-fetched idea.
You know, I think that the brain is a unique obsession of the West.
And that's where you started your research, too.
That's where I started my research. But the Egyptians, for example, would mummify all of the organs of the body, but they would liquefy the brain and drain it out and toss it away. They thought the brain was one of the least important organs in the body.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced
out through the nose it came for them, too.
Oh, yes. And as a result of my work with the healers and the shamans of the Americas, I've come to the conclusion that the mind is mad. It's completely mad.
I've come to the conclusion the society, the way that we live it today, is rather insane.
It is insane. But the nature of the mind, the obsessive quality of the mind, and the clinging quality of the mind, and the identification with our egos that is so the attribute of mind, is madness. It keeps us in disease. So many of the shamanic practices are designed to help you to lose your mind and come to your senses, so to speak.
Or plug into a higher state of mind or something.
Right.
Yep. Tell us about this. First of all, I want to ask you, in your book, you spell Inca I-N-K-A rather than the more standard spelling of I-N-C-A. Why is that?
Well, for one thing, nobody agrees on the spelling yet.
Oh, okay.
So some people spell it with a C. The more accepted spelling today is with a K. But the origin of this is that throughout the Americas, there was never a written tradition. There was only an oral tradition. And this is why shamanism and the medicine ways are so new, is that they have not been studied until very recently, until people like Margaret Mead began to take seriously the traditions of the Americas. Because if you look at Buddhism, for example, we've been studying Buddhism for 200 years, the West has, Christianity for 2,000. These are all, and students of religion have focused only on the traditions that left a written body of knowledge. And the ones that didn't, which is Hinduism and Buddhism and Christianity, the ones that did not, which are the shamans of the Americas, were never studied. In fact, the assumption was that if they did not have writing, that they were illiterate.
Well, actually, what about all of those books, those codexes that the Spaniards burned, of the Maya, for example? Those were written records. They just might have been in symbols that we have yet to completely understand.
They were pictograms.
Well, the Chinese have pictograms. We call it writing.
Absolutely. But Chinese have left volumes and volumes and volumes, whereas the codexes, there's only a dozen or so.
Well, and there used to be hundreds. They just became bonfire material,
right,
unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you look at the Mayan codexes, they're depicting historical events that have taken place. They do not encapsulate a body of teaching like the Bible
or the literature or plays
or the Vedas or the stories.
I see. And that was all an oral tradition. You're
that
saying
was
it was there, but it just wasn't written down.
It
Why didn't they write it down?
An oral tradition. Well, I'm convinced that they realized that if they were to discover writing, they would end up having attorneys at some point.
Good answer.
it was best to forego the entire process.
Well, here's another idea. You point out in the book, and you put this in such interesting terms, I have to bring this up. You said that we in the West are people of the precept. We change a document in order to change the world. We have great reliance on documents in the written language, in other words. The Greeks, by contrast, were people of the concept. They thought the most powerful thing was an idea whose time had come. An idea, a simple idea, could change the world. The Inca, you say, were people of perception. They changed the world by envisioning the world that they wanted through a matter of consciousness, through application of prayer and meditation. So that was more of a living tradition. You know, they felt it was all here in the here and now, which is similar to the idea that we can access God and the Creator in the here and now. It's a living process as opposed to, you know, it all happened 2,000 years ago and we have to go through go-betweens to get there again. Yeah.
You know, the interesting thing about this is that it says that through perception, you can also access a healed state. Say that you're suffering or someone you know is suffering from a terminal illness that only 3% of the people that have this condition survive. So the choice that the shaman faces, that the medicine person faces, is do I become a statistic, in which case the odds are that I will join the 97% part of the scale, or do I track along that 3% window for a future healed state that can begin to inform who I am today?
It's all a matter of choice and where you place yourself in the consciousness of things.
So what the shaman can do, what we can do, is to really access who we're becoming, and have that future state begin to inform who we are today.
But that's a reliance on self and the transformation of self, as opposed to reliance on things in the outside world, like medicine and doctors and technology.
Right. Absolutely.
So a different orientation. Tell us a little bit, before we get into this, these teachings that do help in this process of transformation of self, tell us about the teachers, Don Antonio, and there were others.
Mm-hmm. You know, the teachers are the indigenous peoples. They are they're the Indians. And I was very blessed and fortunate to have had some wonderful, wonderful teachers. And I think it's important to have a teacher. The teaching is always available, but the teacher keeps you focused. It keeps you on the path. And I remember when I first began studying with Antonio, who was my mentor for over 20 years, he would say to me, Alberto, you have a lot of information, but very little knowledge. And I'd ask him, what do you mean? But he would throw a little jab at me like that, he would call me Albertito, which in Spanish means little Alberto. And I would call him, wait, I say, wait a second, it's Dr. Albertito. He would say, you have a lot of information, but very little knowledge. And for the medicine person, the difference between information and knowledge is that information is knowing that water is H2O, but knowledge is being able to make it rain.
Ah, good example.
And that is the essence of the medicine way, is that you don't just read all the books and learn how quantum physics allows for this to happen or does not allow for that to happen, or how there are 9 different levels of consciousness or 12 different or 10 Sephiroth in the Kabbalah. No, it has to do with making it rain, with making it rain. It's not just with intellectual understanding. It's so much of spirituality in the West is very heady, and it's not experiential. The medicine person believes that you have to be able to grow corn with it. We have to be able to change the world with it, and to change our world, our personal world, our families, the world of our children, our relationships, our villages, our communities, and of course the planet.
Well, speaking of rain, you tell the story of a village in Bali where a medicine woman came, hadn't rained there for months and or years even, and she goes in, does the meditation, it rains, and they say, how did you do that? She said, well, you were out of balance, so I put it in balance so the rains could come. So that same idea, which is echoed in the Chinese philosophy, that it all just needs to be in balance and things will work as they ought.
Correct. You know, another example of this, of being in balance, is that for the shaman, there's no difference between being killed by a microbe and being killed by a jaguar.
Ah.
they're exactly the same thing.
How did they understand the jaguar and the microbe in that way then?
Well, for us to be, when you're killed, if you're killed by a microbe, it's a disease, it's an illness. And when you're killed by a jaguar, it's an accident. And for the shaman, they're both exactly the same. You have to be in proper relationships in balance with microbes and with jaguars.
So the agent of your destruction doesn't matter. It's the fact that you let yourself open by being out of balance to destruction.
Correct.
Okay.
That is such an important understanding, that the world only becomes predatory. Jaguars and microbes only become predatory when we're out of balance. Whereas medicine, for example, assumes that microbes are always predatory.
You have to kill them. They're in constant warfare.
It says that when you cut yourself, suddenly these invisible organisms are coming and they're feeding on you and having sex inside you. You've got to sterilize it, you've got to clean a wound up.
Uh-huh.
But the shaman will say it's only when you're out of relationship, out of balance, that jaguars and microbes become predatory.
Well, this is an expansion on an insight that a friend of mine has. We call him a sacred ecologist, and he is of the opinion that crops don't need pesticide. Crops need to be grown in their full health. They need to have the proper soil and this, that, and the other to grow healthy, and that insects come and invade only those crops that are diseased, because nature's edict is to take out that which is out of balance.
Right. If you can extend that into humans,
then you've got the same concept.
You've got an interesting concept there. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. So tell us about this luminous body and how some of these healings are performed. Tell us about your time when you were with pneumonia in Peru.
Well, let me preface.
Not a comfortable place to have pneumonia.
Not a good place when you're up at 12,000 feet altitude. The first, there's an interesting notion that I want us to look at briefly, which is the sense that that there's a difference between healing and curing.
Okay.
That curing is what we do very well in the West with medicine. And healing has to do with coming into wholeness and into balance and into relationship with heaven and earth. And I have seen many, many, many cures that did not result in healings. People that have gone into surgery, that have had tumors removed, that have been cured but have not been healed, and that 6 months or 2 years or 10 years later re-express disease in their bodies again. And I've seen many healings that have not resulted in cures, in which the client has died, but they've died in peace. Now, a healing will most often result also in a cure, because when the soul, the spirit is healed, the body follows. And the idea is that healing happens at the level of the luminous energy field, which is an aura or a luminous envelope that surrounds the physical body, and that organizes the physical body in the same way that the energy fields of a magnet will organize iron filings on top of a piece of glass, so that the luminous energy field is creating the physical body in effect. And illness will manifest in the luminous energy field months and even years before it becomes apparent in the body. So that when I'm working with a client, for example, I will work in removing and clearing the imprint for disease from the luminous energy field before it expresses itself in the body. So you don't have to deal with it in the emergency room or in the hands of a surgeon.
Can you do this remotely as well? Does this also operate on the level of quantum physics?
You can do it remotely as well.
Yeah.
Very, very easily. So the idea is to heal disease before it has had a chance to organize physical reality.
Right.
But even after it has done so, you want to clear the blueprint. You want to clear the blueprint, and that informs the physical body. It disinhibits the body's immune system, and healing is accelerated very rapidly.
I think that this is a concept that has to be integrated into the Western mind, because in quantum physics tells us it's all a sea of energy, and the shamanistic point of view is that this energy, the thought, the stuff is all stuff that has an effect on us, that can hang around, that causes an effect, that there is this bleed through between the physical and the more subtle realms.
You know,
and so clean up the subtle and you clean up the physical at the same time. And so because we have this in our science, because the scientists are saying, yeah, this is the new rule book to do with quantum physics, then it's got to be integrated at some point. Maybe this is why the Western mind is being so opened up to this. And then, of course, we look to the shamans, because they've been doing this for how many thousands of years?
You know, Laura Lee, for the medicine people and for the shaman, the quantum physicist is still in kindergarten.
Well said. Yeah.
Absolutely still in kindergarten. They're getting really excited about discovering that water is H2O, and the shamans are out there making it rain.
Yeah. And, well, you know, we're still debating, is it or isn't it? And the shamans have, for many thousands of years, said it is. Now let's get on with it and find out what it does and how to work with it.
Precisely. And the shamans will say it is and it isn't. So, but we still, let's get on with it.
And we're talking with Alberto Volodo and his book, Shaman, Healer, Sage, as well as Dance of the Four Winds and Island of the Sun. I'm Laura Lee. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. We continue our conversation with anthropologist Alberto Volodo. His newest book, Shaman, Healer, Sage, How to Heal Yourself and Others with the Energy Medicine of the Americas, looking deeply into the wisdom of the Inca and their healing techniques. They say it's time for the West to learn them, because we need to heal ourselves, put ourselves back in balance before we can put the world back in balance. And actually be in balance with the world. It's not that we put the world in balance. We balance ourselves, then we have a balanced relationship with the world, and the world has a balanced relationship with us. I think we need to reorient ourselves into that give-and-take interactive relationship, with things around us, don't we, Alberto? Alberto, are you back?
I'm back.
Hi. You know, I just want to say that this relationship with Earth and with the feminine principle goes so far. It's interesting that you believe that the reason non-Western women don't get osteoporosis as they age is because they maintain a relationship with the feminine, and that can even influence how their bones take up minerals and keep calcium, whereas in Western societies, this feminine principle is disconnected to a large degree, and we're more susceptible to osteoporosis. I mean, it's fascinating, the ripple effects of some of this stuff as you see it.
Oh, tremendously. Our beliefs really influence our well-being so deeply.
Or the fact that we're in harmony has this subtle relationship can actually influence the way our body handles physical matter and nutrition and our bones and our hormones, etc.
Yeah, you know, when we're disconnected from nature and from the natural world, we're disconnected from our natural selves as well. And we're no longer sustained by those energies that sustain all of life, which, you know, the Chinese call earth, air, fire, water, and spirit. When we reestablish a connection with nature, we also reconnect with our own nature.
Well, also the Chinese idea is that when the qi or the life force is blocked, things start falling apart, so you unblock it and it flows, and then it takes care of itself. And so that could look at that body-wide, or you could look at that society-wide.
Right.
Unblock the energy, which is why the focus on this luminous body, right? It's another way of looking at unblocking the stuff that's getting in its way, I'm assuming. So let's talk about this luminous body. What is this? How do we understand this?
Well, the luminous body has been called the aura in other traditions, and it's a luminous envelope that surrounds the physical body. And if you'd like to think about it, it's the skin. It has a skin in the same way that we have a skin that creates an inner sacred space that separates you from the rest of the world, and that protects you, that maintains your energetic integrity. And that also holds a reservoir of vital life force, of vital energy. And this luminous energy field actually informs the physical body and the emotional body and the physical world. It organizes the experience of the world around us. You know, you remember Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, the great mythologist.
He's one of my favorites.
He told me, I had the chance to spend time with him many, many years ago. And he said to me one time, Alberto, if you don't learn it, you end up marrying it. And what he was referring to in a very joking manner is that we tend to recreate life situations over and over again, the same kind of relationships, the same kind of marriages, the same kind of work situations that create an opportunity for us to heal.
You get stuck in it until you get it right, and then you can move on, and only
precisely.
Then.
Precisely.
Okay.
So that the luminous energy field also contains a blueprint for our psycho-spiritual and our emotional selves that continues to organize our physical experience of the world and to recreate experience situations in which we will have the opportunity to heal. And I had a wonderful example of this with a client of mine who came to see me because she was in great, great sorrow. Her only son had died in an automobile accident 5 years earlier. And she had let him go out that evening against her better judgment. And she blamed herself for his death. And every September 26th, which was the anniversary of his death, she would have a near-death experience herself. So one time she was stopped at a traffic light and somebody rear-ended her. She ended up in the emergency room. The next year she had an allergic reaction to a food she was eating at a restaurant, ended up in the hospital. They gave her barium for an exam, and they found out she was allergic to barium when her heart stopped. And when she came to see me, she said, Alberto, how can my luminous energy field be organizing people rear-ending me, hitting my car?
And why didn't she learn to just stay in bed and close the drapes and lock the door on those days?
Well, in a way, she was recreating a near-death experience for herself to be able to heal the loss of her son. So she was compelled to leave the house. She could not stay indoors.
So she brought about this experience in order to confront the issue surrounding death or as a punishment to herself, to absolve herself, or what? What was her,
well,
what do you think her
really
subconscious reason?
We never found the exact cause for this, except that what we did discover is that we cleared the imprint in the luminous energy field. When we erased the blueprint, that come next September 26, she was able to mourn and grieve the loss of her son without needing to recreate those dramatic circumstances again.
So how do you go in and clear this luminous body, clear this imprint? How do you find the imprint? How do you know where it is? And how? What is the clearing techniques that you use?
The techniques have to do with discharging the energy that feeds the imprint. And if an imprint, we all have these imprints that we bring with us karmically from a former lifetime or that we develop through early life trauma. And these imprints are generally dormant until one of them gets clicked on. It's like when you double click on an icon on your computer and suddenly the program is activated. When one of these imprints is activated, it hijacks our central nervous system and our life experience.
So they're like viruses just sitting there lurking, waiting to get activated.
Yes, and it completely takes over. And when it does, look out. You're compelled to go into painful situations that are very difficult to get out of. Now, the way we access these imprints is through the chakras. So we enter, because these imprints in the luminous body inform us through the chakras. So we've got to go through this one of the seven chakras in the body, the seven energy centers in the body, to access these instructions, these programs that are encoded in our energy, in our energy system. And then
now,
we want to overwrite them.
Okay, so that's the access point is the chakras, and then we overwrite them.
Mm-hmm.
Understood, similar to the way that we use computer programming. But my question is, I thought the chakras were something that were understood by the Hindus. How did the Inca, how did they understand them? Do we have pictures? Do they understand them in the same way? Are they twirling energy vortexes? Are they located in the same spots as the Hindu place, the chakras?
Mm-hmm. You know, my students often ask me that, and they say, I thought chakras were Hindu, and I tell them...
Well, they're universal, right?
I tell them, I thought livers were European.
standard equipment for everyone.
So if they're part of our luminous anatomy, they're universal. And what the medicine people learn to do is they learn to see and to sense the chakras and the acupuncture meridians. For example, in Spanish, the chakras are known as eyes of light, ojos de luz, and the acupuncture meridians are called rivers of light.
Okay, that certainly explains looking at the flow of energy, right?
Right. So the techniques in the Americas have to do with learning to see these rivers of light.
Of course, because that's why they call it a luminous body, because they're seeing it or sensing it. Are these the eyes of the soul? Are these seeing with their physical eyes? Are these sensing with hands? I mean, how do they perceive them? Or is everyone different and have different faculties of perception?
No, in the medicine traditions of the Incas and the way that I was trained by my shaman mentors, you learn that everything that you're seeing is actually created inside the human brain. In fact, seeing happens in the back of the head, in the visual cortex, and then we project it out into the world.
Right.
So what you learn to do is you learn to see the spaces in between things. You learn to see the subtle nature of life, not the gross material.
Both should be accessible to you. If you're seeing the physical, you should also be able to see the space
and
between the atoms.
We all have this ability. And these are techniques that are 5,000 years old that have been tested and proven over and over and over again.
They wouldn't have lasted that long if they didn't work, in other
words. Precisely.
Yeah.
This is not something that I channeled. This is something that I translated and adapted to a Western setting and that are as effective in the West as they are in the indigenous culture.
Can you give us a quick exercise or tip on how we can begin to turn those eyes on, to begin to see?
Absolutely. You know, the chakras are directly related to our immune system. And whenever you have a condition that is not healing and resolving itself rapidly, you probably have a dysfunctional chakra, an energy center that has collapsed. And in Shaman Healer Sage, in my book, I describe the location of the chakras and the functions associated with each one of those, the psychological programs and the memories that we have stored in each one of the seven chakras in the body, and two other chakras that are outside of the physical body.
So you look at your ailment, you say, this is the corresponding chakra, this is the chakra that needs a little help reviving itself.
So what you want to find is which chakra is not spinning, is not active in your energy system. Activate that chakra and spin it in a clockwise direction, as if your body were the face of a clock and your hands were the hands of a clock, spinning it in a clockwise direction to re-stimulate, to reactivate that energy center, and in doing so, you kickstart your immune response.
Clever.
So there's an immediate and direct relationship between the chakras and our health.
Makes sense, because it's just, are you opening the path for the life force to come in? Right? Or are you closing, letting it be closed off through time and
trauma? But you know,
trauma.
We live in an immune-depressed culture. And and when you stimulate the chakras and strengthen the chakras, we are allowing the body's natural healing systems to come into play. And they're extraordinary. They're absolutely extraordinary.
What are you actually doing? Is this a mental technique?
Well, it's not a mental technique. It's a tracking technique. And what we teach our students is how to track, but instead of what you would ordinarily do with tracking is perhaps to track a jaguar in the rainforest or to track a deer in the woods, what you're doing is you're tracking energy. You're tracking luminous strands that will lead you to an original wounding that took place. It might have taken place 30 years ago or 300 years ago. And when you find that original wounding, you tap into the energy that is associated with it. And then you're able to discharge that energy, to cleanse it, and then to reinform the luminous field, to overwrite it, so that those instructions are no longer operant.
So you go to a time bomb, and you defuse it, and then you are able to clear it, and then the natural imprint is able to shine
it's
through.
Erased, yes. Yeah. You know, this is actually easier to do than to explain.
Yeah,
because it's we don't have the vocabulary for it. But let me tell you a story of how I first became aware of these imprints. My mentor would send this myself and another one of his students into funeral homes to practice seeing, the luminous energy field. And this was in the city of Cusco, high in the Andes, which is the capital of the Inca Empire. And it was just, back then it was a smallish town. And whenever someone died, you would hear about it. And we go into the funeral home, and after all the family members had left, we would linger behind and dim the lights, and we would look for the luminous body that was separating from the physical body. The soul, in effect, if you, what we call the soul in the West. And after probably a dozen of these times of relaxing, of meditating, I saw for the first time the luminous energy field like a golden egg rising above the person's body, the person who had was deceased. And I couldn't believe it. And when I looked inside this luminous egg, I could see the seven chakras of the body contained within this luminous orb.
What did the chakras look like within this luminous orb?
They looked like points of light.
Uh-huh.
Like blinking points of light within this luminous egg, which is what we call the soul in the West,
That
would then migrate after death to its next body.
You know, I'm thinking of the Egyptians depicting the soul rising from the bodies in the tombs, mm-hmm, as little egg-shaped things with wings.
Precise. Well, that's exactly what the shaman perceives, except that in the Americas, the medicine men and women developed techniques for being able to see. And the Egyptians, of course, did as well.
Yeah.
This is where that these images come from originally. They're not metaphors, but they're records of the experience of a man or a woman who was able to open up their vision into the invisible world.
Yeah, but go on.
No, that's...
No, you're telling us about these, what the chakras look like in this luminous egg in this exercise. So then what? You learned to see this.
That was the very first time that I had actually seen the luminous energy field. And when I went up to the coffin to see who this was, we normally had come and had practicing with people that had died of old age. And I looked inside this little rustic coffin, and I see a little girl, an 11-year-old or 12-year-old little girl with a brand new red dress, and she had obviously died high in the mountains, perhaps of malnutrition or of an unexpected snowstorm. And I began to weep. I began to cry. I was so touched by this, and I said to my friend who was older than I was and who was training with me, I said, look, we have to help this young woman. We have to help her make her journey to the spirit world consciously, to leave her body behind so she no longer is identified with a physical body that is inanimate.
So she doesn't hang around and be a ghost, right?
So she's no longer suffering, right? So she wouldn't have to become earthbound, so she could return back home, back to the world of spirit. And my friend says to me, Alberto, you know we're only supposed to come and practice seeing and maybe say a prayer. We're not supposed to do anything. And I say to him, look, we have to help this young girl because her spirit was still stuck to her body. And I said to Jose, I said, look, you know more what you're doing than I do. You help this young girl to disengage from the physical body and make her journey back home, and he did.
Now, did you know, just before you get to that part, did you know that she was stuck because the luminous egg went up and just stayed there? It didn't continue on?
It was connected right to her belly.
You could see like a cord, like a silver cord that they talk about?
No, we could see the bottom part of this egg stuck right in her abdomen.
Oh, so it wasn't able to really get lift off and dissipate into the heavens. It was
stuck. It wasn't
stuck.
Separating.
Okay.
It was still, and the... So he went and performed the death rites, which is really the greatest gift that we can give to a loved one that might be departing. It's assisting them to die consciously, to make their journey into the spirit world as elegant and as peaceful and as blissful as possible.
And this can be done just after they pass away or
right
before?
During or immediately after they pass,
mm-hmm,
away.
Okay.
And these are rites that we have lost in the West. So anyway... my friend begins to disengage the chakras. He disengages all seven chakras, and suddenly we feel this wind just rising from the middle of the room, and we sense this incredible bliss, like we would were in the middle of a cathedral.
I'm getting chills.
So blissful, and we knew that her luminous body had been released, and we were there hugging each other, and then we were so proud of ourselves. We take a bus back to our mentor's house, and we get there at about midnight, and we walk in the door, and he says, "What have you two been up to?"
And we You're both, going, did I do something good or something bad, right?
And we both
going,
say,
uh-oh.
Nothing. And he says, "What have you been up to? Who is this that you brought home with you?"
Oh, my gosh.
And what happened is that the spirit of this young girl had followed us home. We didn't know the complete death rites. We didn't know what we were doing. I was in my late 20s then. We didn't know what we were doing. We thought we were helping her, and she had followed us home. And then he,
And your mentor saw that, of course.
He saw her hovering right behind us. And we were so delighted with ourselves, so pleased with ourselves. So he had to open up ceremony and assist this young spirit to return back to her home, back to the spirit world.
Well.
And this is the final chapter of Shaman Healer Sage, where I present the death rites in a way that is very practical and that we can use here to assist the loved one in making their journey back home a conscious journey.
Boy, so it shows you that when you perceive this subtle energy, so much is explained, isn't it, in terms of...
Oh, so much becomes
clear. And so much
clear.
Can be done, yeah.
So much becomes clear.
Tell us a bit more about this discordant energies that are just out there bouncing around, looking for a victim, or what?
There's a lot of discordant energies. There's a lot of pent-up rage and anger. In fact, here in L.A., when you step into the freeway, the amount of road rage is extraordinary. But in the jungle, this would be considered sorcery when somebody directs ill will or harm at you.
Whether they know they're doing it or not.
Whether they know they're doing it or not. Or when we undermine our own selves.
So you can self-sabotage yourself without knowing.
Because the worst kind of black magic is the one that we do to ourselves all the time. But in a case like this, when you're dealing with energies that do not belong to you, that penetrate the luminous energy field, and that embed themselves in your energy or even in your physical body, you have to extract these. And we don't, you cannot do this in psychotherapy. It takes 10 years to do in psychotherapy.
If it's successful at all. We're coming to the end of our hour, and I just want to say thank you so much for all of the work that you do and for bringing the message back from these Inca elders and shamans.
It's a pleasure to have been with you, Laura Lee, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
So what can we bring away with us today? What can everyone take away from this to begin to understand it, put this into the computer of our brains and to start looking at that the world in a new way?
Well, two things. I think that the one is that I believe that today we have no choice but to become shamans, all of us.
Survival,
to take charge of our own destinies and the stewardship of the earth.
Yeah.
And secondly, that it's important for us not to inform ourselves only in terms of who we have been, both genetically, medically, psychologically, from what we inherited from mommy and daddy, but to begin to inform ourselves in terms of who we are becoming 10,000 years from today.
And this is, of course, coming right in time for the fulfillment of the Inca prophecy, which is to say, if we are to transform ourselves, and this prophecy has been in place, this is not a New Age prophecy, this is an age-old prophecy that's been in place for many hundreds, if not thousands of years.
It is happening
right
now.
It's a cyclical thing.
As we speak.
Then, it's going to be a bumpy ride as things get even more topsy-turvy, even more insane in our society. But I guess it forces us to the wall to really look at ourselves in new ways for our own survival and well-being, to adopt some of these expanded worldviews and perceptions, to start becoming the shamans that we all have the potential to be, and that will in effect produce the new human. This is our destiny, you're saying. We have the ability, it's just hidden in within us, just needs to be turned on.
See, I am convinced that we all chose to be born at this time because we didn't want to miss out on this tremendous upheaval and change that is happening in the world.
Yeah.
And that the options that we have are, do we want to be riding at the top of the wave, surfing the top of the wave, or do we want to be caught in the wave?
Or pummeled beneath it. And
right.
You also say that, you, unlike the evolutionists who think that, that change happens between generations, you say, and the shamans say, no, it happens within a generation. We can transform ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then that jump-starts the next generation, jump-starts the change in the world.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
We are the ones that we've been waiting for.
We are the ones that we've been waiting for. Thank you so much, Alberto. That was Alberto V. Lodo. Enjoy your journey. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com